Hi. Welcome to the Podcast. I'm DevOps Dan.
I'm Ternary too. That was a good jingle. You're doing yourself a jingle.
Well, because the episode was so good, it put me in a good mood. It was such an information-dense episode that I'm just really excited to get out.
Yeah, it was excellent. We were joined by Josh Doody, a salary negotiation expert, and he basically... It's just 101 what to do to renegotiate your salary. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. He wrote a book called Fearless Salary Negotiation. You can read it for free at fearlesssalarynegotiation.com. We plug it a few times through the episode, and there's a link in the description. Chapter 4 specifically is how to negotiate your first job. And that is basically what this episode is about. So much sage golden advice on how you can negotiate, practical things you can do before and during a negotiation. We even cover benefits and perks outside of salary that might get missed. I don't even know where to begin. It was so good.
Honestly, just gold, real gold. Yep. Stuff that we haven't heard before, stuff that really resonates with bootcamp grabs. And I was looking at his website beforehand, and I think it does look a little bit intimidating for people who maybe are just sort of starting their journey, because it's all about high earners. And even in the show, Josh is talking about like very big numbers, but the advice, it's brilliant. I don't feel intimidated by that. I think just dive in, download the book and read it, because it's really useful.
Yep, for bootcampers, even more so, I think, than everyone else, people who are coming from different walks of life and then trying to dive into the world of tech, this kind of advice is going to help.
It's going to blow your minds.
Yep, enjoy the episode, and we will see you on the other side of aforementioned episode.
I'm Josh Doody. A salary negotiation coach for high earners, which involves people from a lot of different industries, but a lot of people that are in tech, going to big tech companies in particular. I'm based in Gainesville, Florida, here on the East Coast of the United States.
Florida is a big Iron Hack state, I think.
Yep.
Is it the only state in America with an Iron Hack campus? So you're in
we have a campus in Miami, and that's the only one so far, right?
Yeah.
You know what's funny is technically you're right. That is in Florida, but that's also a 5-hour drive for me. Wow. So it's like Florida's such a big place that even though the one campus is in Florida where I am, it's still a long trek to get there.
Yeah. Well, worth the trek to meet some of the students, I'm sure.
Yeah. To head down there sometime.
All right. So why don't you kick us off by telling us a little bit about the book that you wrote?
Sure. Yeah. So in 2015, I wrote a book called Fearless Salary Negotiation, which was really a passion project that was sort of based on my own experience negotiating job offers. Due to some kind of unusual career choices that I made, my friends and family would frequently come to me and just ask me career questions, in particular how to negotiate salaries once I kind of started doing that on my own. And I also had a background that was in HR software that did compensation planning, and I had been a hiring manager. So all these things kind of came together into one sort of clump of skills that enabled me to write the book really just for fun. And so it's a book that is designed to be very easy to get through. It's pretty short and quick to read, but very tactical, which is the way that I think, because I have an engineering background. So I just kind of think in like, do this, step one, step two, step three. So I published that book.
Documentation.
In 2015. Yep. Tech Docs. Yeah, yeah. And then that kind of is where my business started. But it began as essentially just a passion project. I did not think I was going to build a business around it. That was never the plan when I wrote it, which I think makes it a little bit more pure. I was writing it because I wanted to write it. I thought it would be helpful, and it turns out it was really helpful for people.
Nice. That's a good starting point.
Yeah.
For a business.
I think so.
It's like, maybe this is my hobby. Maybe it's going to be my job. Wow. Now it's my job. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the dream, though, right? Start off with something that's a passion project, and then what was it they say, Tim? You'll never work a day in your life if you find something. That's regular.
It. You never work a day in your life if you're talking about salary negotiation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like that. I mean, I will say, unfortunately, I have had to work some days, but most of the work that I do, I really enjoy it, which I think in a weird way helps the business keep going. I've never been sort of a salesperson, and yet I have to sell essentially sort of high fee consulting engagements. That's if you zoom out a little bit, that's pretty much what I do. But it's easy for me to do that because when people that I are considering hiring me, when they talk to me, they can tell that I'm just really enthusiastic and I just like what I do. And it, you know, I have a lot of social proof and other kind of results to back up that my work is also valuable. But I think that it's sort of infectious. And so they talk to me and they're like, man, he's so into this and I'm so not into this. I should just hire him and let him walk me through this thing. The fact that it started as a passion project, I think has been part of the secret sauce of what makes a business work.
Okay, so let's start at the top then. Walk us through for all of the people who might not know out there, what are salary negotiations and how are they different from like a pay review, for example?
Yeah, so that's a great question and you made the right distinction up front there. So salary negotiations, really, probably there's two versions of them. The one that I focus on is the one where if someone is changing jobs or starting a new job, they'll get a job offer and then I help them negotiate that job offer to be as good as it can be. And the other version of them would be more around reviews, which is a raise. So negotiating more compensation at your current job. This is counterintuitive, but those are totally different processes. I mean, they couldn't be more different. The new job offer situation is different because you have a lot of leverage as the person that they've identified as the right candidate for this job. And so that gives you a unique opportunity to, before you kind of sign on the dotted line, to work with them to negotiate the best version of the offer possible with your primary sort of a leverage fulcrum being the fact that you haven't yet said yes to the offer. Whereas when you're already working at a company, you can negotiate more comp, but you're already working for them. And so you have less leverage there in terms of they've already got you employed at the company. And so it's a little bit more difficult to move the needle. So you can get a much more significant improvement, say in an initial job offer, than you could in negotiating a raise later on. But those are the two primary versions. You mentioned reviews. Those are also frequently tied to raises in terms of merit increases and that sort of thing. And so that makes it even a little bit more complicated to negotiate raises at your current job when they're around the review cycle or the merit increase cycle. So my primary focus is on negotiating job offers when people change jobs as opposed to negotiating raises. I do have a course on that. I write about it in my book and I do help people with it occasionally. But 97% of the work that I do, maybe more, is new job offers.
Yeah, the biggest increase you get is always a new job, right? In your career, the biggest step up in terms of salary is always the next new job. So the initial negotiation is always a much bigger step, I guess, than anything you'd ever get internally in terms of a review or a pay rise.
Yep, exactly.
From our point of view, you know, most of our listeners, they're newly fledged in the world of tech. So maybe we could talk about some misconceptions that people have about salary negotiations. Are there sort of like some common misconceptions when people start on this journey, especially into a new career and what they're expecting?
Yeah, so I think one common misconception is that if it's your first job, you can't negotiate. Sometimes that's kind of true. But even then, it's not that you can't negotiate as in like the job is going to go away if you try to negotiate. It's just possible that if you're at a stage in your career where you're going to companies that are making boilerplate offers to people, sometimes it can be really difficult to negotiate those. And that's really more of an economic kind of supply and demand sort of thing. But in general, you can negotiate a job offer. You may not get an improvement, especially if it's your very first job, if your first job in tech, your first job as a software developer. But there's no reason to not try to negotiate that job offer. And there might be room to improve through negotiation. So that's one common misconception.
It can be really scary, though, to say, can I ask for just, you know, a certain amount more money? That as soon as you touch the money topic, I think that it's a, I mean, it's so profoundly common that when you're, especially your first job, you're so happy to get it. To risk shaking the boat in any way by saying, actually, can I just push this money up a little bit more? It's a really hard step to overcome. I think that it's one of them things that if you don't, you know, you don't ask, you don't get, but it's, it makes you nervous to think about, I think.
Yeah. And a lot of, so I don't think I realized this was true until several years into my business, but one reason that my book works well for people and that my coaching is effective is that I have a good methodology for negotiating, but also there's a kind of a multitude of ways that you could negotiate, right? And you can think about this in terms of any negotiation that you might do. If you're negotiating like the price of a car or, you know, haggling with somebody to market, there are different ways that you can engage in a negotiation. Some of them are almost offensive in how aggressive they are, right? Making ultimatums right out of the gate, telling them, I'm just going to give me this or I'm walking. So technically that's negotiating, but it's not what I'm doing, right? Yep. And so what I'm doing is saying,
I don't need you.
Yeah, right. And so it's like there, I think part of the way to mitigate that fear that you talked about, obviously you mentioned, you know, the fear or being scared to negotiate. That's why my book is called Fearless Salary Negotiation. That's why my business is called Fearless Salary Negotiation, is that it is scary. And it is, to be clear, it's scary for me. Every time I work with a client, we send a counteroffer and I get a little bit nervous. And that's, you know, I've done hundreds of those. And yet every time I'm still a little bit nervous. So it is a scary process. But the reason that I still send that counter and work with a client is that I know that the way that we're negotiating, the words that we are using are collaborative words. They're aggressive. We're pushing hard sometimes, but we're collaborating with the person that is our counterparty that we're negotiating with. And so, again, I didn't really realize until a few years in, but one reason this works well is that we take the edge off the negotiation and turn it really from kind of a hard-nosed negotiation between sort of competing counterparties into a collaboration between or among people who want the same outcome, which is ultimately they made you a job offer. They want you to go work for them.
Nice.
You're negotiating because you want to go work for them. And so you're both trying to get to the same place. And so it's about kind of standing alongside them and working together with them. And so the way that you negotiate does matter. It's not, I'm not saying I don't care how you negotiate, do whatever you want. You'll get a good outcome. I'm saying if you negotiate well and you follow certain steps and you have a collaborative mindset, that you can find the best possible results, even if that best possible result is occasionally there's no improvement to be made in the offer because it started as good as it could be. That's rare, but it's possible.
Collaboration's a good word for it. You know, like help me help you, pay me more. You know, let's do that.
Yeah, basically.
So, yes. So, in your book, you talk about researching salaries, right? But that raises a lot of questions for me. So, what's a good way to find, you know, what a good salary is? You can just ask peers. Obviously, it changes with location too. I mean, you can Google prices for, in our case, Berlin developers, let's say like that. But what are some good resources people can use to find a reliable estimation of what their worth is, I suppose?
Yeah, so there's a sort of a visual metaphor that I use when I'm thinking about this, and it looks like a bullseye or like concentric circles, right? And so I think when you're starting, what you're trying to do is get to that bullseye. You're trying to get to the middle of the target. But the best way to find data like you're talking about is to start at the edges, at the big circle. And what I mean by that is like, you know, what is the market rate for an entry-level software engineer? What's the market rate for a senior software engineer? What's the market rate for an AI engineer? What's the market rate for a PhD machine learning engineer? These are all very different questions. And so, you know, in general, just finding a number is good. Usually I would start even kind of geographically, right? So you mentioned Berlin. So I might say Europe, or I might say North America or Australia or wherever I'm looking, right? You kind of start there, mostly because cost of living and what people are paid just vary so drastically across the world. But yeah, you start broad and you say, all right, well, you know, in Europe, what are entry-level software engineers making doing this kind of work? And then once you have that information, you have a baseline, right? So that's your kind of first number. You might write it down. And then I picture, you know, moving in on those concentric circles to the next level, which is like in the country that I'm looking at, or even in the city that I'm looking at, or in the United States, like the state or the area of the region of the United States, whatever that is, what are the engineers making there, right? And then once you have that sense, so now you've started with your first number, which is like in the industry, in this very general geography where I start. You kind of move it as a slider to like up or down based on, well, in this area of the country or this city or this country, this region, they pay a little bit more. So I slide it up a little bit more. And then you look for, you know, in the particular industry that you're looking in, right? And so there's a difference, you know, between like what a software engineer will make in fintech versus big tech or, you know, consumer retail or whatever those industries are. And so now you're getting more and more specific as you move in through these circles. And eventually you mentioned like a peer or somebody who has worked there, somebody who does work there. That could be really valuable information and might even trump most of the other information, right? Because if you can actually talk to somebody who works at the company and say, what does an L4 engineer make at this company? And they say about this, then that gives you a much more specific idea. And so you're continuously moving it in. You want to adjust by cost of living and that sort of thing for the specific city. And if you can get information from the specific company or from people who work at the company. This is an unusual example, but at Google, for example, there's a spreadsheet that floats around that a lot of people voluntarily put their comp into. And so if you can, you know, and it's pretty much publicly available in Google. And so occasionally I'll ping somebody that I know at Google and say, hey, can you look at the magic spreadsheet and tell me what you see for this? There's lots of different data, and there's sites like levels.fyi to kind of start you with that biggest circle. Team Blind is a really good site for the biggest circle. And you just kind of slowly move in and adjust that number until you get to, you know, the center of the circle, hopefully, which is like, what is the going rate for an entry-level engineer at this firm?
Nice. Very useful. And do you think that's those numbers have been affected by the kind of advent of remote working? Have you found that that's kind of being pulled into salary negotiations now? If you're kind of working for a company, which you might be, you know, maybe the company's based in Berlin, but you're living in rural Germany, you know, is that something that that kind of companies can, I don't know, hold against you when it comes to paying you more because it's like your cost of living is lower?
Yes, sort of. So it's interesting, especially, you know, a few years ago through the pandemic, everybody went remote, right? Because we had to. And now there's a lot of, you know, return to office kind of stuff. It's interesting because this doesn't come up as much as I kind of expected it to in negotiations. I think a lot of that is because by the time I start working with people, the job description and the role, the posting, the requisition, whatever you want to call it, that's posted, frequently calls this out from the beginning. And so it's not, you know, you don't get to the end of like the interview process and get an offer and they say, by the way, you're going to need to come into the office 50% of the time. It's not a surprise. And so I think that doesn't come up in negotiations because, you know, the thing that you're even considering negotiating began as something that was described as remote full-time or in office full-time or hybrid or whatever. It does sometimes affect subtle parts of the negotiation. Like there's a concept that I use called minimum acceptable salary, which is essentially just sort of your baseline for like, this is the number that I have to be paid to take this job. It's a very important input. I like to have people set it before they start getting job offers. And the reason is that it gives you sort of an objective baseline. So you could just use a round number. You know, if I don't make $100,000 total comp, I'm not going to work at this job. And underneath that are reasons why that might be true. So that might be true because that's the market rate and I don't want to be paid below market rate. It might be true because this is 50% in office. And if I'm going to have to commute half the time, then I need to be paid enough to make it worth my while to commute, right? There's also cost of living and stuff in there too. So I think it has subtle impacts on it, meaning it's rare that you would say, as part of this negotiation, I'm going to negotiate that I'm full-time remote, because the job was probably posted in a way such that it's very obvious whether that's even a feasible thing. And you may not even be talking to this company if you have to be remote and they're not hiring remote. But it does, you know, again, it's a subtle effect that it might have on your negotiation in that you say, well, I understand that I need to come into the office full-time or part-time, and therefore I'm not going to accept this offer unless it's less than this much. And if it's less than this much, it's not worth it for me to commute. And I'll walk away, or I'm willing to take a little bit of a pay cut even relative to the market rate, because I can work from my office at my house and I don't have to get on the train every day and go to work.
That's actually very in line with another Doody that we've interviewed in the past. Sarah Doody is a previous guest of the show.
Do you know her? Are you aware of?
I don't know her. Well, that's not true. I've interacted with her like on Twitter and on the internet, but I don't know her personally. But I think we're both mutually aware of the other Doody, and we will frequently have what you just mentioned, which is like, oh, she was on a podcast.
Yeah, you're like, I guess you're peers in that sense and moving in the same kind of parallel circles.
We are. We're in, you know, not the same area, but adjacent areas where we interact with a lot of the same people.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because she was talking a lot about this base setting a baseline of like what you're willing to be obviously paid, but then, you know, around the entire job. So like what you actually want to be, what you want to do, what, you know, your role and like how you want to handle it. And I think that's very good for first time interviewees or people who are just starting their career into tech, because, you know, setting those goalposts from an early stage really helps you filter down, you know, the prospects that you might have and where you're going to look for work. So
yep.
I think that's good to hear it kind of chiming with the previous interviews, which is cool.
So what advice do you have for, let's say, bootcamp graduates, people who have done a short intensive course to learn, let's say, coding or web development, design? What advice do you have for bootcamp graduates preparing for their first tech interview?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm going to immediately kind of split your question into two areas. One of them is technical interviews. So coding interviews, whiteboarding, stuff like that. And then the other is what I call like a fit or behavioral interview. They're called different things at different places, which is more of like the, how do you think, are you a good fit for our team and our company culture and that stuff? So on tech interviews, I basically have no expertise there. I'm an engineer. I write code. But I always just defer to, there are lots and lots of tools, but obviously LeetCode is a great place to study. My friend Parker runs a company called Interview Cake, which is specifically around technical interview prep.
Interview Cake.
Interview Cake. Nice. Yep. Yep. I think they're focused on big tech, but I think it's also sort of company agnostic. So there's a million resources out there to help prep for technical interviews. And I think of those as a totally separate, they feel different. They are different. A lot of times they're take home. So you're not even really interviewing. You're just doing a take home project. Then you have your fit interviews. So the thing that I recommend for the fit interviews, and that's something I do talk a lot about, because this can impact your ability to negotiate later. So it's directly aligned with what I do. Is your job is to, especially as an entry-level engineer coming out, if you're doing your first tech job out of a coding bootcamp or something like that, chances are you're applying for jobs where there are going to be lots of other applicants who are similarly qualified. You're not a specialist. You haven't got a niche that you're working in yet. You don't have a ton of experience to differentiate you. And so your resume is going to look like other people's resumes who are applying for that job. They're going to be very similar. So your job in the fit interview is to differentiate yourself somehow. And since you can't really do that on experience necessarily, you differentiate on, I would say it's conscientiousness. It's awareness of what the company and the team and the person that is going to be hiring you are working on. And so the main two things that I say to focus on in those fit interviews and your basic interviews are goals and challenges. Those are the two words that are magic words. So you want to understand what the goals are of the company or the team or the person that you're talking to. What are they trying to accomplish? And as an aside, I tell people this, and I think it helps them to understand kind of why I focus on this. The chances are that the person who is interviewing you right before your interview, they were busy. They were doing something else. They were trying to solve a problem. They're putting out a fire. They're trying to ship some code. They're doing stuff. They're managing whatever they were doing. And then they got a bing 10-minute reminder that in 10 minutes they have to interview you. And they're like, ah. And so they start scrambling. They're trying to get it done. That's why they're frequently going to dial in late to your Zoom call, because they were trying to get stuff done. They were sending emails or whatever they were doing. They're in another meeting. And then they're going to stop and they're going to interview you. And then when they're interviewing you, they're thinking about that stuff that they were just doing. They're thinking about what they have to do next. And this interview is probably just a thing that they have to do. Whereas for the interviewee, the person who's being interviewed, it's a big deal. This is my interview. I might get, you know, so it's, they're totally different perspectives. But the manager was interrupted from doing stuff, is going to interview you. They're probably thinking about the stuff they were doing and they're going to do. They finish the interview. Yeah. They go back to doing the stuff. That's how it works. And so the stuff that they're doing is either trying to accomplish certain goals or trying to overcome challenges. They're trying to solve problems, put out fires, whatever that is. And so your job as the person being interviewed is to identify what they're trying to accomplish, what's preventing them from accomplishing those things. So your goals and your challenges, and to describe to them how you're going to help them do those things. And so now you've turned from a piece of paper with a bunch of qualifications that probably look like a bunch of other entry-level software developer type qualifications to a person who understands the business at a macro level, or the team, or even the hiring manager that you're talking to, what they're trying to accomplish. And you're telling them, hey, listen, I know that you're working on this project right now. I have a passion for that kind of thing, or I've actually worked on a couple of projects like that through open source in the past, and I'll send you some links. Or I know that you're trying to overcome this challenge that you're having with your database indexing, and I happen to spend a lot of time doing database indexing, and I can help you overcome that if you bring me on the team. And now you're a totally different person. Yeah. And so throughout the interview process, I think you should do this. The last thing I'll say is this is, again, a situation where you have the concentric circles metaphor. You start wide, right? So if you've never talked to anyone at this company before, you don't know what the goals and challenges are of that hiring manager, unless the job description is very explicit in what they're trying to do. But generally, you'll know what the company's trying to do. You can look at their mission statement. You can look at their social media. You can read articles that were written about them. You can read financial statements if they're public. And you can figure out, what are they trying to do? What is their mission statement? What are they trying to accomplish as a company? And is there stuff that's blocking them from that? So if you're looking at financial statements, the word headwinds will show up a lot. Those are their challenges. Sometimes it'll be published, the things that they're trying to overcome or whatever. And so you start there. And then as you're interviewing, everybody that you interview, probably at the end of the interview, will say, hey, I've been talking for 45 minutes asking you questions. Do you have any questions for me? And by golly, you do. The questions that you have are, what are your goals? What are you trying to do right now on your team? Yeah. What's your North Star? And what are your challenges? What are the things that are keeping you up at night? And the beautiful thing about this question is, like I said, they're already thinking about those things. And people love to talk about stuff that they're thinking about. So they're going to be like, oh, we're working on this project right now. And like, we're getting a lot of pushback from the whoever. But I think it's really going to work. And so we're trying to do these three things. And we're focused on this thing right now. And this one thing is really jamming us up. And I was actually doing that this morning before I jumped on this call to interview you. And then you can either start interacting with them real time about that, or you can just write it down after the meeting and say, okay, well, now I know what the goals and challenges are. The next person I talk to, who's probably going to be somebody on that team or somebody adjacent to the team, now you can start to formulate your interview answers to talk about their specific goals and their specific challenges. And now you're totally differentiated from the stack of resumes that they have on their virtual desk.
Gold standard advice. That nice.
Because I think about it a lot.
It's great for. Yeah, I just think that it's great to have that that line into the team at the end point of interview, because that's sort of like, have you got any questions? Is often quite
difficult. You could, even just the way you phrase your answer. I was thinking about a problem you might have. Is it exactly this problem, which I happen to know? You know what I mean? Maybe that's a really nice way to get ahead. So good. Yeah. Okay. All right. So from that golden piece of advice to the next one then, how do people with limited experience in a certain field use their past experience? So a lot of people that come to our boot camps used to be in the service industry, or maybe they were a dancer, or and now they're moving into a tech industry, but there's still a lot of skills that can be carried over. There are a lot of transferable skills. How do you leverage them in an interview in a new field?
Yeah, this is a great question. And one reason is I didn't write these questions that you're asking, but if I had, this would have been the sequence. So the way that you use past experience is as a differentiator is also tied to the goals and challenges thing. So one thing that's interesting is it's one thing to identify a goal or a challenge that someone has, and then it's another thing to tell them how you would solve that problem or how you would help them to achieve that goal. Because you have unique career experience, your way of approaching that goal or that challenge is going to be different than almost anybody else. And so if you can tie in your previous experience, even if it's implicit, so you don't have to say, you know, at my previous job, we did things like this, but you can say, oh, here's how I think about that problem. And it can be informed by your career experience. And so this is a great example of how you can differentiate yourself. And again, you're trying to get away from the stack of resumes. That's your challenge as somebody who's entry level, is you're competing with people who are similar to you by definition. The way that you do that is identifying goals and challenges, being conscientious, helping them understand and help. But now you get to also fold in, this is not my phrase, but a skill stack, right? Like every person has a unique set of skills that they have. So you can combine those skills in basically infinite different ways. The thing that you can do with your previous work experience is combine those skills with the challenge that they're trying to overcome or the goals that they have, and use your previous work experience skills to help them address those goals. And now you've done two things. You've told them, I'm going to help you to achieve the goal. And you've told them that you're going to help them achieve the goal in a way that's probably different than anybody else who might say something similar. So that's the primary way I would use it, is to think, how can I use this previous experience as an asset to me to help accomplish these goals. And if you come from different industries, you're just going to have a different perspective on things. That's where a lot of consultants come from, is they have this weird, you know, they were in oil and gas and now they're moving on to medical sales or something like that. And that person's just going to have a very unique experience and background on how to sell things. So that's the first thing, is I would use that experience as a lever to help them solve the challenges they're facing and address the goals that they have.
Nice. Also great advice. So if we take this bootcamp grad's point of view, they've nailed the interview. They've kind of sold their soft skills in the previous job. But then the negotiation itself is often quite intimidating. Are there any like practical tips or strategies that you could, you know, sort of, employ them to use off the bat?
Stand like a superhero beforehand to improve confidence.
Yeah. Power pose. Stand in front of the mirror. Yes. So this is the nice thing. I will send you all a link. You can read my book online for free. It's on my website. The whole book is there. FearlessSalaryNegotiation.com/book.
There's a link to that in the description in chat, if anyone's listening right now.
Yeah. So you can read it there. And you know, I, in an interesting way, I make my living by, charging people money to either coach them or to buy my products. But also I'm aware that there are a lot of people, either because of stage of life or because they don't even have a job yet. They've never had a job in the industry they're going to, that they're just not going to have any money to spend on stuff like that. And so you can read my book and tons of articles for free on the site. And that's by design. Just because I think the more people I help, the bigger that footprint is and the better off people will be.
I would have thought you could charge whatever you want and then just negotiate people to pay for it.
pay what you will. Yes, I consider that. So I think that's my first tip is, you know, the reason I mentioned the book is that part of the way, you know, my book is called Fearless Salary Negotiation. The reason it's called that is because it's scary to negotiate. And my book is meant to be, it's the subtitle after the colon is a step-by-step guide to getting paid what you're worth. In other words, there's literal step-by-step tactics that you can follow to negotiate, even if you have no idea what you're doing. And so for me, at least, now this isn't true for everyone, but for me, just having somebody say, do these six things in this order is relaxing to me. I say, okay, I've outsourced now all of my stress because I have a process to follow. And in my case, I can say, you know, I don't know how many thousands of people have read my book and used it. I've coached hundreds of people one-on-one, like it works. So that's the first thing, is just go read the book. Chapter 4 is about how to negotiate new job offers. And just follow the steps. It's very tactical. So that's the first thing. I know it's, I guess, kind of a plug for the free version of my book or something, but basically what you're going to do is, first, the minimum acceptable salary is something that I mentioned. So that's really helpful for me, for my clients. I use it literally with every client that I talk to. I say, if you haven't gotten a job offer yet, I need you to take some time and think about what your minimum acceptable salary is. I need you to know what your baseline is for whether or not you're going to go work for this company. With any luck, the offer that you get will exceed that number right away and you won't have to worry about it. But that's you're setting the table for the negotiation. The second thing is, don't talk about salary numbers before they make an offer. So they will frequently say, hey, we're thinking about making an offer. Before we do, we're wondering what you were hoping to make if you come work for us. Don't share that information. I can unpack that if you want, I'll give you just a super high level thing that you can say, which is, I don't really have a number in mind. I know that I'm going to be a valuable asset to this team. I'm really excited about this opportunity and I'm looking forward to this move forward in responsibility and compensation. I look forward to hearing what you think for comp when we get to that stage. And so you're just sidestepping it and saying, let's just keep moving. So those are the two big things before you even get an offer. One, the minimum acceptable salary. Two, don't share your comp expectations. That sets the stage so that you're getting an offer that you have not accidentally sort of handicapped before it came to you. You haven't put yourself at a disadvantage there. You know how good it needs to be for you to get there. Then your job, of course, is to negotiate it, to either jump over that minimum acceptable salary bar or to just improve the offer. Basic strategic tips for negotiating. One, avoid phone calls if you can. recruiters are very good at negotiating job offers. They do it in one day and certainly in a week and absolutely in a month. Most recruiters are going to negotiate more job offers than you will in your entire career. And frequently, like I said, in a day, they will do that. You're at a huge disadvantage if you try to get on a phone call and do a real-time, you know, verbal negotiation with a professional negotiator. You're not going to win that negotiation unless you have a sales background. Those are the people I find that can actually kind of pull that off because they're used to selling, and it's sort of a reverse sales process. So avoid phone calls, which means you will counteroffer over email. There's a template in my book. There's a template on my website. And basically the counteroffer is a way for you to put your case into writing. So not only is it you're countering a number, but you're also saying, here is why I think I am more valuable. This will sound very similar to the goals and challenges thing that I mentioned earlier. It's almost literally that, where you'll say, I'm good at this thing, which is going to be valuable to your team in this way. So it's the same framework. And so in that counteroffer email, you're saying, here's my case. Here's why I'm a valuable asset. Here's what you offered. Here's what I would be more comfortable with. That language is very important. Back to our collaborative, aggressive idea. I'm not saying, give me this money or else. I'm saying, you offered $100,000, I'd be more comfortable at $115,000. And then you see what they say. So you're going to send that as an email for two reasons. One is to stay off the phone, as I mentioned. The second reason to send that in an email is a lot of times what you're asking for will need some kind of approval from somebody who is not the recruiter. And the person who needs to approve the additional comp will say to the recruiter, why should we do this? And you don't want the recruiter to try to summarize your case for why you should get paid more. You want them to say, here's an email, I'll just forward it to you. I know that sounds like I might be making it up. I'll tell you, recently, I think the last client I worked with, or maybe right before that, he had pixel tracking turned on for his emails. And so he sent the counter offer, and then he emails me like an hour later, and he's like, well, they've already opened the email 7 times. And I said, no, they didn't. They forwarded that email. I've actually seen data from a client who's a sneaky software engineer who actually tracks his own outgoing email open rates and stuff like that. And we could see in real time it was opened, and then a few minutes later it was opened again and opened again. And that's because, you know, couple of people in the organization on the comp team, probably in the hiring manager, were probably CC'd on the recruiter's email when they forwarded it and said, he's asking for a lot more money. What can we do? And so that's just better for you. So the counteroffer in email is something that people will push back on, but it's better for you to be off the phone, and it's a way for you to make the case that you want to make in your own words, so that anybody who you can't see behind the scenes that needs to approve your new comp can see your case in your own words, instead of a recruiter who's trying to fill 20 roles right now, trying to articulate why you're a good fit and why you might want to get more money. And then that's the main thing. The last tip I'll say is, if you're looking for a general range, and again, this is like, I don't have any idea what I'm doing. What do I do? You're going to counter over email, and you should counter between 10 and 20% above what they offered you. 20% is when you feel like they're more motivated to hire you. 10% is when you feel like they're less motivated to hire you. So in other words, you know, if they're trying to fill 30 open positions, they have 100 people working or applying, and they've told you that, they're going to be less motivated to hire you because they've got 99 other people that they're considering for all those roles. On the other hand, if they told you, like, we've been trying to fill this role for 6 months, we love your interview, you did great, you're the person we've been looking for, they're more motivated. So you're going to be closer to a 20% counter. So that's my rule of thumb is 10 to 20%. So if you're looking for a number, like I said earlier, you know, they offer 100K, you should be thinking, am I going to counter 110 or 120 or somewhere in between? And the spectrum is dictated by that sort of rule of thumb that I mentioned. So those are my things that you can do to negotiate successfully if you really don't know anything else negotiating.
Love it.
Okay. Yeah. Then let's just keep it going then, because of the process we're in here. What about perks? Can you give us some advice on perks and benefits that are often overlooked, especially in tech, that people might not think about when they're negotiating? Some top things people can keep in mind outside of just salary.
I think this is particularly pertinent for people who are starting off as well, because I feel like graduates often get that, like, we can offer you this, but we've also got a ping pong table, etc.
Yeah.
So I think this is particularly because if you're kind of dazzled by the fact that you might get XYZ, then I think it's really
pizza night once every really, 6 months
useful.
Yeah, free snacks.
Exactly. We will post you a
bagel slot. Fridays.
Yep.
Yeah.
So the way that I think about perks is, anytime a client that I'm working with asks about one of these things, the first thing I say to them is, how important is that to you? And what I mean is, part of the negotiation process that's a little bit more detailed, I didn't mention before, is prioritizing the stuff that you want. So most of the time for most people, it's going to be either base salary or equity, depending on where they're going. So, you know, if you're going to a company that doesn't have, they're not public and they don't have RSUs, then you're probably going to want to maximize base salary. If you are going to a public company that has RSUs, you might also want to look at equity. And then the list continues to your target bonus, your vacation time, how much remote work you'll have to do, all the way down to, you know, there's a ping pong table in the rec room, right? And so the first thing that I think is important to do is to prioritize. I usually say your top two or three things that you care the most about, and focus on those things. So in other words, you don't want to lead with something like the ping pong table is a great example. You don't want to lead with that because that's an easy yes for them. It costs them nothing to give you a ping pong table. They've already got the ping pong table. You can use it whenever you want. And so you say, well, I would like another $10,000 or access to a ping pong table. They'll say, I'll tell you what, you can have unlimited access to the ping pong table. We can't give you any more comp. And now you're kind of stuck because you asked them for some stuff and they gave you one of the two things. You know, they gave you 50% of the things you asked for.
Ping pong.
Yeah. Well, so that could be a conversation. My client might say, listen, I'm not going into the office unless I could play ping pong. So that's my number one priority. And then we might say, okay, you know, like we're going to make sure you get a ping pong table if it's a deal breaker. So that's my question is this a deal breaker for you? Usually the ping pong table will not be. And the things that are deal breakers are comp or something like that. And so you have that list. The way I say it is you list the things most valuable to least valuable for yourself. If you flip that list upside down, that's probably the list that the company would make in terms of least expensive to most expensive for them, right? That's what they want to do.
That's a good little piece of advice. If you flip it, that's probably how they want you to see it, or how they would not want to. Okay.
For that reason, you don't want to do what a lot of people tend to do, which is this always makes me feel sad. So they'll send me an email. It'll be like somebody that's on my mailing list. Hey, I just negotiated. Here's the email I sent them. What do you think? And it's one of those emails that's like, okay, I'd like another $7,000 in salary. I'd like a $10,000 sign-on bonus. I would like a $25 per month stipend for my cell phone. And just like, it's a laundry list of things. And I'm like, oh man, this is bad because I know that you got three or four of these things and it probably is like a grand total of $800 a year that you got for yourself. When if you had just said, I want more salary, full stop, you probably would have gotten more salary, well over $800 a year. So you want to start with that top priority. That's not to say that you can't negotiate perks. So the second thing that I will try to do is identify what are the things. So a perk is starting date. That's something that comes up a lot as well. I want to go on a vacation. You know, I'm finishing up this boot camp and I want to go to Italy for 2 weeks before I start working. So should I leave with a start date? No. And the reason is that there's sort of a secondary negotiation that can happen for this kind of thing that aren't the deal breakers. So you figure out what the comp is, and then you say, okay, because you have a second leverage point. The first leverage point was you're a person that can do this job, so your yes is valuable. But the second one is you've agreed on comp and everything, but you haven't signed the paperwork yet. They still have to get you to sign. So the recruiter still has to close the deal, even though you agreed to comp. And so that's when you can say, hey, before I sign this, I noticed the start date is a week from now, 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks, four. I was wondering if we could push that back to 6 weeks, right? And they'll almost always be like, sure, whatever, I don't care. And so that's something that you could have used as one of your primary pillars of negotiating, and it's a freebie. Like they were going to give that to you, just like the ping pong table. You could lead with the ping pong table. They're going to say yes for sure. And you probably could have gotten it for free if you just asked for it later or didn't ask at all. So for perks, I think it's good to think about what are the perks that are available, but also to make sure that you put them in the part of the negotiation where you don't accidentally cost yourself a bunch of comp. So some perks that I mentioned a few of them. Vacation time is one. Weirdly, the smaller the company, the more likely this is to be negotiable. If you're going to work for Amazon AWS, it's unlikely you're going to negotiate more vacation time for yourself. It's a one size fits all. They have a rubric. This is what you get. Whereas if you're going to a smaller firm that's, you know, let's say they're not public yet, they've got 1,000 employees, they're going to IPO in 2 years, you might be able to get another week of vacation. Sometimes they'll do it because it's, you know, they're still kind of doing bespoke comp packages and HR stuff for people. So vacation is one. A sign-on bonus is one that some seem to be more aware of now than they used to be. But that's one that I usually leave it. It's usually like third on the list of cash money things that they can get. Remote work is something like I mentioned, usually you already know the parameters, but sometimes you can say, hey, listen, can I on Fridays, I'd love to stay home, work from home so that I can pick my kid up from school. Right. And sometimes companies say, yeah, sure, whatever. You know, as long as you're in the office Monday to Thursday, we don't care if you're not there Friday. So that's a perk that you could think about. Those are the big ones, I think. There's also continuing education stuff, or maybe you could ask them if they'll throw in, like they'll send you to a conference if there's an industry conference you'd like to go to every year, you know. They might say, sure, we'll send you that conference, and that could be thousands of dollars that you don't have to go out of pocket for, and that kind of thing.
They can be really, really useful too. You can make some great connections if you play those right. And
absolutely
to your second job. So definitely think about those boot campers out there.
Don't tell them that during negotiation.
Nope. It's baked in. I think everybody knows it. Yeah. You know, you're there to learn, you're there to network. Everybody knows that.
Okay, so before we go then, I'd like you to the stage is yours. Is there anything you want to promote? Anything you want? Any place you want to point people? Even if it's some reading advice, it could be your book or a different one. Anything that you want to plug right now? The stage is yours.
Sure. Yeah, I'll run through some things. So fearlesssalarynegotiation.com is my website. Like I said, that's where I run my business, but also there's, hundreds of pages of free stuff, including my entire book can be read for free there. So definitely check that out. My book is Fearless Salary Negotiation. I have a program called Salary Negotiation Mastery, which is sort of an intensive self-paced course that you can buy and do on your own that is awesome. You mentioned other books. So there's a book that I really enjoy. It's called The Dip by Seth Godin. It's almost more of a pamphlet than a book, but I think for people who are early career, especially, it's a great book because it's basically about like when it's time to do a new thing. And so I used it a couple of times, that kind of idea, when I was changing jobs, and thinking, is it time for me to leave this job and go to a new one? So The Dip is a great book. It's cheap. It's very, very short. But I've given it to probably 20 people. I recommend it to people all the time. So check out The Dip. That's my plug for somebody's stuff who's not mine. Great book. I think it's a good decision-making book that will help you think about hard decisions and when it's time to quit a thing and start a new thing.
Yeah, there you go. And that was the episode. What do you think of that, Tim?
I have filled a book of notes, a tome of notes.
Yeah, I feel like I have to have no job interviews coming up or even any on the horizon, but I feel like I'm prepared to negotiate.
I feel like something like bigger companies could offer is just like fake interviews.
Why?
To
help people negotiate themselves out of the company.
Well, no. Like, you know, people who are going to apply, it doesn't really work, does it? It has to be a paid for service.
Yeah. Otherwise, plus the company, they don't want you to be good at negotiating if you are the company.
Yeah. If you apply and you're like, yeah, okay, I attended your webinar of like how to be really good at negotiating.
Can I have an extra 15 to 20%?
As per your instructions.
Yeah, that's absolutely not going to work. I know what you mean. I think what you were trying to say is that the information should be more readily available.
Yeah, definitely.
That and taxes. I need more information on taxes. Difficult.
If we got, I don't know how interesting a tax expert show would be, but if you want to do it, mm-hmm. let's do it.
Yeah, find one. Anyone out there, reach out. Reach us at ironhack@taxnegotiation.com. Subscribe everywhere good podcasts are available. You might be listening to this now on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not, and you are an Apple user who's been using Spotify thinking, why aren't they an Apple Podcast? We are now. You can find us on Apple Podcasts. Yep. Enjoy that.
If you want to watch us, you can on YouTube.
This video will also be on YouTube now?
This bit will not be on YouTube, but the interview will be. Yeah.
Right. Well, enjoy the rest of your day, weekend, evening, morning, afternoon, wherever you are. And bye for now.
Bye, 1,000 times.